This is Richard Verone, and we're starting another session with Ambassador Fong. It's October 16th, 2002, 2:45 p.m. in the afternoon, and we're again joined by Ms. Jenny Board. Ambassador Fong, if you would, let's continue discussing the Paris Peace Conference, and let's look back at 1968 and discuss why the Paris Peace Conference happened, why it happened when it did, how it came about.
Well, if you remember, President Johnson tried very hard already in 1965, 1966, and concretely at the Manila Summit Conference in October 1966. There was a clear need or desire by President Johnson to get Hanoi to the negotiating table in trying to find a peaceful solution to the conflict.
Why do you think President Johnson was trying to do that so hard? Was it because of the presidential election year, or did he think? Do you think that he thought that America simply could not do what it intended to do?
Well, I think that you must say right at the beginning, it was not the intention, I'm sure, of the U.S. government, whether from President Truman to Eisenhower to President Kennedy and then Johnson, to have such a massive intervention with crown troops and then with air support from the United States in order to maintain the political regime in South Vietnam. And then we have to go back a little bit here to see how the United States were brought to that point of going into negotiations with Hanoi by the year, shall we say, 66, 67, or 68. I think that it would be interesting to try and find out, you know, how the whole so-called Vietnam War, you know, developed since the Geneva Accords of 1954, and to read the mind of Ho Chi Minh and his communist government in Hanoi. The Geneva Accords of 1955 was a big victory for Ho Chi Minh. That was the first time that he had international recognition. And he was very keen to maintain and keep, you know, what he managed to achieve, that is the creation of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. And that would play all the way throughout the Vietnam War till the end. That is, that entity, should it call, or state, country called North Vietnam, labeled the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. How come that the United States was not prepared, you know, in 1964, 1965, to destroy North Vietnam, launching the war? So that was very crucial for Ho Chi Minh and the Hanoi government to maintain and to preserve that notion of North Vietnam being a sovereign country. And thanks to the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China, they had the support to do that and considered it as a sanctuary in the fight for the whole of Vietnam. So sanctuaries in the Vietnam War was not Laos, Cambodia. The biggest sanctuary in the Vietnam War was North Vietnam. So there, if we try and read the minds of Ho Chi Minh from 1955 to 1960, he did not, honestly, we must say he did not try very hard to overthrow anything in South Vietnam.
Let's pause just for a moment.
Yes. So I think that after the Geneva Accords, 1955, with the partition of Vietnam to two, I think Ho Chi Minh was sure that he was going to have the whole of Vietnam under communist rule, under communist regime. That was the eventual withdrawal of all the French troops, and then general elections coming in 1956. There was no competition against Ho Chi Minh at that time. It was just Emperor Bao Dai. The state of Vietnam created within the French Union and so on and so forth. So South Vietnam came into existence without any government, mm-hmm. without any governmental structure, but anything left by the French.
Right.
It did not have any army. The South Vietnamese army did not exist at that time and was just probably the remnants mm-hmm. of, you know, the Vietnamese presence mm-hmm. in the ranks of the French forces which were left. So I think that Ho Chi Minh did not worry much about that kind of South Vietnam. And maybe he believed sincerely that South Vietnam wouldn't be a match to him. Militarily, it was not a match to Jap, mm-hmm. for sure. He defeated even the French mm-hmm. expeditionary forces. Politically, there was a complete void. Mm-hmm. And how are you going to fill that void in 1955-56? And in face of that, you already have a so-called Democratic Republic of Vietnam in North Vietnam, which was well supported by the communist bloc. See? So he was very confident that it is a matter of very short time. He would take over the whole of Vietnam. But then...
Even in the face of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization?
Yes, but as you see, the Southeast Asia CETO was just, a token military alliance without any, you know, striking force whatsoever. If not, you have to call on the United States to act. It was not like NATO. Mm-hmm. CETO was just an empty shell, you see.
Okay.
And the members of CETO, if you take out the United States, wouldn't mean anything at all. NATO, if you take out the United States, would still be able to do something by itself.
Mm-hmm.
But then, we have to go into those details, because they can't. If not, we present a picture which may have all the 10 toes and 10 fingers, but they don't mean much. And it is also in the context of the rise of the Soviet Union as a nuclear power, and the creation of the People's Republic of China. So, I think it is valid and justified that the worry or apprehension of President Truman with the rise of the Communist bloc after the Second World War, and then very clearly with President Eisenhower, and particularly with the very forceful Secretary of State, Foster Dulles, they were anti-communists very clearly. And the threat was very clear, very real, you see. That is, the spread of communism, especially in the former colonies, so that was very clear. Was there any other choice for the United States at that time except beef up the so-called South Vietnam, which just came into being? The United States did try to help the French a little bit, carry on the fight, but it was a hopeless fight. And then,
do you think the Americans realized that the French were fighting a hopeless fight?
Well, I think President Eisenhower was very aware of that, because the context of the thing was very different. And the French carried on with a kind of colonial, you know, endeavor there. And President Eisenhower did say to Paris that you should change, you know, mm-hmm. your banner. They should go for, you know, fight against communism, mm-hmm. the spread of communism, and you are fighting for democracy and freedom, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it was an impossible task to give to the French. They did not have the means to do it, and they were not in position to do it after 100 years being the colonial power in South Vietnam. It would be very difficult to say that I'm a different French guy coming back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was and the French colons were still there, you know, exploiting the plantations and having their beer put mm-hmm. out and all kinds of things, and take advantage of the former colony as they used to do. So it was, I think, a surprise to Ho Chi Minh that not only managed to create a state, you know, with the very little means that he had, although the American came in to give help. And if I remember correctly, you know, between 1954 or 5 until the early 1960s, by 1963-64, the U.S. did put in, you know, about nearly $2 billion mm-hmm. in Vietnam, mm-hmm. of which, I mean, almost 80% went into beefing up the South Vietnamese army. Mm-hmm. So what's the, with the creation of MAC, and then MACV, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there was no other choice. But you must say that North Vietnam did not really start a war during that period, during 1955 to 1960, mm-hmm. you see. And they escalated very slowly with rather subversive activities, with what they used to do in the 1940s, that is assassination of the village chiefs and so on and so forth, throwing bombs into movie houses and marketplaces to disrupt, you know, the certain government in South Vietnam, been setting up by Ngo Dinh Diem. Ngo Dinh Diem, as I said, projected an image of a Mandarin, you know, of the imperial court, and at the same time trying to bring in Western values mm-hmm. and impose, really, literally, you know, Catholicism, you know, as the philosophy, or as the, shall we say, the ideology. See? But there was a clear effort on the part of Ngo Dinh Diem not to be a puppet of the United States, because he was, you know, an old Mandarin, very conscious of the Vietnamese nation and people, and he would not accept, I'm sure, you know, the rule, foreign rule. But he was in dilemma, because if he did not, he was not prepared to accept politically, you know, the influence and intervention of the U.S. government, he was desperately in need of their aid in order to survive. He managed to play the tightrope there, which didn't turn out very well for him, because he did not really play the American card completely. And then in order to build up that country and government and the state, mm-hmm. which he managed to do with the deposition of Emperor Bao Dai, and then the creation of the First Republic of Vietnam with him as president. Mm-hmm. And here we must be also honest that the referendum and the so-called election to make him president was not in the best, you know, democratic tradition, mm-hmm. but it would be difficult for anyone to do else you know, differently. You see, so because you know, elections in that context, it wouldn't mean much anyway. To
do you think that in the context, the world context of the 1950s, with the United States' vehement anti-communism stance all around the world, mm-hmm. that the United States got in limited at the beginning with the South Vietnamese government, but simply because the American presidents, Truman and then Eisenhower, and mainly Eisenhower, had said South Vietnam will exist, it will be backed by the United States, it will be an outpost of the free world, it will be an anti-communist state. Simply because of that comment and that public acknowledgement by the United States government that the United States had just committed itself to making South Vietnam survive. And so my question is, did it matter in this context? This is what one school of thought of historians think. Did it matter in this context that whatever President Diem wanted or didn't want, or what the South Vietnamese government wanted or did not want, the United States was going to be there, it was going to be very influential regardless because of its worldwide anti-communist stance. So did the Saigon government have any choice in the matter of the fact that, yeah, if the United States abandons us and we have to deal with Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnam directly, and we lose somehow, that it's going to be a black eye on the United States because we had made this public statement saying that we were going to protect South Vietnam, it's going to be an outpost of the free world. Do you think the Saigon government had any choice in this at all, in the from 1955, 56, 57?
As you have very rightly put, you know, the issue in its historical context, mm-hmm. The basic issue here is not Vietnam. The basic issue here is the beginning of the confrontation between the communist bloc and the United States. And here I think, as an intellectual exercise, we have to, you know, go into the details. The United States were apprehensive of the spread of communism. Mm-hmm. But what kind of spread of communism that we were dealing with, you see? That is to say, the Soviet Union did not use the Red Army, you know, and try to invade, you know, other countries. They claim that it is the spontaneous, you know, decision by the peoples concerned here and there in the world to choose the communist ideology. Mm-hmm. And they claim all the rights in the world to be communist. What you were against is the use of acts of war, of violence, you know, to communize, to impose communist rule on other peoples. And there, you find yourself in a very special and particular case of Vietnam. You did not have yet, you know, anywhere else in the world, you know, a war between communist forces and non-communist forces, except in Korea, which was another very special case, mm-hmm. You see, that was not the spread of Chinese communism or of Soviet communism in Korea. It was something else, you see. So here you are faced with that, and you commit yourself to put the spread of communism in Vietnam, taking South Vietnam as your defense line. Mm-hmm. And also I think it is true to say that at that time almost everybody were attracted by the domino theory.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They say, well, if South Vietnam falls, then you have the whole of Southeast Asia, you know, communists and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Which may well be too, you know, considering that the people were not very aware what communism was or not communism was, mm-hmm. you see. But Ho Chi Minh had the schemes to take advantage, you know, of that period after the Second World War. And then eventually the Genoa Accords of 1954-55, and then you move now to the point that by 1960, Ngô Đình Diệm was successful to set up a country called the Republic of Vietnam with the help of the United States. Mm-hmm. So, but then he was in the dilemma too. He didn't want, you know, American rule, you know, on him, and needed the means to do his job. At the same time, he had to establish a government which would be able to work effectively and provide security, protection to the people in South Vietnam. And the more he became successful, you see, the more effective he was to then set up that governmental structure and build, beef up his army thanks to the United mm-hmm. States. Then Ho Chi Minh, how would Ho Chi Minh react to that situation?
But wasn't he getting help from the PRC and from the Soviet Union in the same kind of way with money and
not
material?
Yet. If you look at the figures of aid, you know, provided by Soviet Union and the PRC to Hanoi, mm-hmm. it went up very slowly, mm-hmm. and you know, compared to the aid that South Vietnam received from the United States, it's nothing. It's about one fifth, or you know, of a. In the aid given to Hanoi at that time, but then because they were two different types of activities, mm-hmm. that is to say, the means used by Ho Chi Minh and the Hanoi government, they did not require, you know, enormous you know, amount of money or means like in South Vietnam. You see, they didn't have the air force and so on and so forth, or navy or anything of that kind. They were mainly, I think, up to 1960, rather on subversive activities, much more than conventional warfare. And then they prepared themselves, eventually, with the consolidation of the South Vietnamese army, You see, Jack had to also consolidate the PAVM, and he was much more effective to do that because he already had, you know, the past since 1940s to set up that People's Army in North Vietnam. So, what happened then? By 1960, see, I think that Ho Chi Minh and the communist government in North Vietnam continue to claim the sanctuary status of North Vietnam. So he was not, you know, they were not crazy enough to launch an all-out conventional attack against South Vietnam that would destroy the status of sanctuary. Mm-hmm. So they would continue with more subversive activities.
Do you think in 1960 he knew whether or not the United States, or I guess South Vietnam, the military of South Vietnam, would actually invade North Vietnam? How did he know it was a sanctuary in 1960?
I don't think that he thought that the South Vietnamese army would be in position to invade North Vietnam. I don't think so.
Right.
But if he launched a conventional attack against South Vietnam, if I were in his shoes at that time, I would expect a retaliation by the U.S. government, you know, with Foster Dulles there, here for sure.
In the form of what happened in Korea.
That's it.
Yes.
You see, so he was very careful not to put himself in that position.
Mm-hmm.
So he continued. But then, in order to make even surer, you know, that he would be safe in North Vietnam, he launched the NLF. In South Vietnam, to say this is not my, business. That's the trouble of the South Vietnamese among themselves.
Right.
See, and he was able to take advantage of it because there was a movement by that time against him. As I said, he was in contradiction himself.
Right.
The more effective he became as a government, the more repressive he had to become. And then the Ho Chi Minh would help him to become even more and more repressive and dictatorial by more subversive actions, you know, the escalation of social selection. But it was not really conventional warfare by 1960.
Right.
And so they claimed that there was the NLF. It was probably spontaneous. I crown that. But there were also other spontaneous movements against Ngo Dinh Diem at that time. You see, the NLF was not the only one movement, and then all the others remained on the Saigon side. But how come that the NLF, with lawyer Nguyen U Tho and then Madame Binh and so on, you know, went to the Hanoi side? So the question here is academic. Really. Whether the NLF was really South Vietnamese or was a tool of the Hanoi.
This is a huge debate.
Huge
scholarship,
debate, you see.
About this.
So it's both, in my opinion.
Okay.
I lived through that period.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that they had, you know, real grievances against Ngo Dinh Diem. It was really, you know, a bloody dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And then I am against Ngo Dinh Diem on that point. That he, by 1960, with his repressive laws and action, he pushed, you know, the non-communist nationalists into the hands of the communists.
Maybe, did they think that Ho Chi Minh and the communists were a better option than what was happening in
South Vietnam? They had a choice. Because the survival and the effectiveness of the NLF depended entirely on whether Hanoi would give a hand to the NLF or not. And now, how was Hanoi then confident that they could, you know, use the NLF? Now, after the reunification of Vietnam under communist rule in 1976, we discovered then that, you know, Nguyen Hữu Thọ and Madame Binh were, you know, been members of the Communist Party for years, the Vietnamese Communist Party for years. So they were very, you know, confident to have their own people in there to really hold the NLF, you see. But then, as I said, on the practical term, the NLF provided a means, you know, to the Hanoi government to act in South Vietnam and then still preserve their status of, you know, sanctuary. in North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So claiming that it was truly South Vietnamese movement. So it was not entirely false to say this, not truly South Vietnamese, but I said that in practical terms, the whole survival and effectiveness of LNF depended entirely on the help from Hanoi. And then you can say that during the Paris peace talks, when they moved to change the NLF into the position of the Republic of South Vietnam with its PRG, you know, provisional government and so on and so forth, that was also to play, you know, the NLF against the Saigon government under the entity of the government. So how was it valid? How much was it valid, you know, to consider the NLF and then the PRG as the counterpart of the Saigon government? And that is a major element in the Paris peace talks.
What is your opinion on that?
Well, if I were in Hanoi, that would be the thing to do, you
right.
see.
Right.
But in practical terms, anybody would tell you that the NNF or the PRG didn't control much, you know, the population or the territory in South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They had a few areas here and there which could be taken by the RVN and the American troops anytime, anywhere. And so it is rather the Leopard scheme, you know, concept. And you don't say that this is my area, you cannot come in, that is your area. That was not the game to be played by Hanoi and the NLF. It was impossible to say that they have really territory government, but they claim they have a government structure, mm-hmm. you know, here and there somehow, and they claim to be representative of the South Vietnamese who were against the Saigon government. So here we have to go to the details to see. So by 1960, you see, President Diem had that dilemma, and eventually he became so repressive. And to answer your question, I think that at some time there was the impression among the officials in Washington D.C. at the beginning, they thought that Diem was you know, the best that you could find. And then when he refused to play exactly the American policy in South Vietnam, then they thought that the man is you know, losing grip of the population and getting out of hand. And that led to the 1963. So for Ho Chi Minh and the Hanoi government, eventually they found out that they were able to bring down Ho Chi Minh, you know, through your subversive action.
Bring down
Ngo Dinh Diem.
Right. You know.
And it was more or less with the blessing of the American. And I must say that after the Geneva Accord in 1955, there was an acute crisis of leadership among the non-communist enemies, as it had always been. Not that we recognize Ho Chi Minh as a very effective leader of the Vietnamese people, but he was the only one who was in position to claim a role of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And as we all know, he was very clever not to project the image of communism throughout the 1940s and 50s when he led the fight against the return of the French forces. And also here, I think that the debate is still going on whether Ho Chi Minh was a nationalist mm-hmm. or a communist.
Mm-hmm.
I am very much inclined to say that he was both. But he was much more communist than a nationalist, because he would not have survived as a nationalist for long if he were not communist.
He would have survived what?
The political game there and the war, if he did not have the support of the Soviet Union or of the PRC. as many other nationalist leaders that crept up during that period of time with the Dai Viet, with the Vietnam Working Band, and so on and so forth. And so he was able, to make use of all the elements, historical context at that time, to continue and claim leadership.
Do you think Ho Chi Minh was more nationalistic than Le Dinh Diem?
The only thing that Le Dinh Diem was not communist, that's something very clear, compared to Ho Chi Minh. And he failed completely because he did not respond to the historical context at that time. It would be very hard to say who had popular support. In inverted commas, popular support. Because the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese people at that time were not very politically conscious of the issues involved. But the ordinary people and the peasants in the countryside were very conscious of the fight against foreign rule, foreign domination, foreign presence. See? So Ngô Đình Diệm had a big handicap because he had the Americans by his side. And in face there you have Ho Chi Minh without any foreign intervention, foreign presence, foreign thing. So that is the big handicap of Ngô Đình Diệm.
One really controversial point that I'd like to bring up now is the question that a lot of American scholars have asked. Did the United States drive the escalation of the Vietnam conflict from 1954-55 forward? Did the United States drive it, the escalation? Or was that the communist side, the North Vietnamese side, that drove the escalation of the conflict?
To answer your question, we have to stick to very traditional and conservative concepts of peace, war and peace. Apparently, the American intervention in the Vietnam War was massive compared to whatever the Soviet Union, the PRC or Hanoi put into that war. But the escalation was not the physical escalation. The escalation for the Vietnamese people was that Ho Chi Minh and his group, and it came out very clearly by the late 1940s to the strictly nationalist parties and people there, that we will be overrun by the Vietnamese communists. Because after the so-called period of coalition, when Ho Chi Minh set up the Republic, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in Hanoi, he had a number of governments, provisional governments, which included all the traditional Vietnamese parties. But it came out very clearly that he began systematically to eliminate them, physically eliminate them. And those people just withdrew from the coalition and began to fight back even before the French returned. But it was a desperate fight. They didn't have anything to fight against Jap at that time, and the Vietnamese ranks were there to include also the non-communist Vietnamese. But those non-communist Vietnamese in the ranks of the Vietnamese were not conscious, or was not aware that they will be, taken over very soon by the Vietnamese communists. They didn't see that. The few who saw that then went over, and it was a terrible choice for them, to join the French forces and fight back Ho Chi Minh, or to remain in the Vietnamese ranks, and know that eventually they will be overwhelmed by Ho Chi Minh and the communist Vietnamese there. That is a very painful decision to make.
To fight against your own.
And in own conscience.
Yes.
I don't really know how to make such a decision. Really, if I were there at that time. That is to accept, eventually the colonization of the whole country of Vietnam. You don't die because of that. You will be subjected to communist rule. Eventually we would know what that means. Join the French forces and have a small chance you know, not to be under communist rule. So it was an impossible choice. It was an impossible choice.
Would you, in 1960s, when you returned to Saigon from England, would you have come back to a communist Vietnam in 1960?
I just mentioned to you when I was in England in the 1950s, mm-hmm. there were about 20 Vietnamese at that time who were students there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how, by whim of fate and destiny, mm-hmm. exactly 10 went back to Hanoi and 10 went back to Saigon.
Right.
So 50-50. And there you are. I went back to Saigon because my father was there, the family was there. But if my father had been like my uncles in Hanoi, I would have gone back to Hanoi, you see. And I would know what would have happened.
So it didn't really matter the political standing. You just went to where your family was.
First of all, it was the family.
Right.
But I'm sure with my upbringing in Europe, in France and in England, I would be very quickly put into jail in Hanoi if I would start to say, to speak up my mind.
Right. You know? Because you spoke with a professor who dismissed communism.
Yes, of course. You remember. I'm not really against communism as an ideology. Uh-huh. You see, so intellectually, I'm against communism because I thought that it wouldn't be a workable system,
right.
Because that was the negation of all the human values and the concept of a human being that we are used to in the West. You see, no more private property, and then you see etc. Mm-hmm. No respect for the minority or so on. And so. Did that matter very much to the peasant in the countryside? I don't think so, you see. And so, I don't know. Even now, under communist rule, you see, they continue to live with whatever they have.
Mm-hmm. So, back to that question.
Yes.
Did the United States drive the conflict, or was it Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnam?
So, I think that the type of escalation that Ho Chi Minh took against Ngo Đình Diệm and South Vietnam later was not very visible, but it was an escalation, from subversive activities, from assassination of the people and the disruption of the peace and the ways of life in South Vietnam. Eventually he used regular units, forces of the PAVN to intervene into that. So that escalation was not very visible. And in traditional terminology, you would not call that escalation.
Right.
It was descent. It was fight. Whatever you by whatever means you had against what you would call repressive dictatorial political regime in South Vietnam. But for the non-communists or the anti-communist Vietnamese, that was escalation in the fight between them since mm-hmm. the late 1940s. And Ngo Đình Diệm was not in position to cope with that. The way he ran the country was not to cope with that, because he failed completely as a Mandarin to win the support of the people. And it was difficult, because it's easy to say that, but it would be impossible for him in his position and in that kind of context to win the support of the people, because first the people was not very much interested in any political stand, but were only interested to be left alone. Nobody would come and disrupt their very miserable life, and that was what most of the people were interested in.
So the struggle really was amongst the political elite of the country
for the leadership, and
it was amongst them,
political amongst elite. Them, and also it was the very very clear combat for power and to have power to rule.
Right.
And so there, the United States found itself in such a context, and in order to put an end to what later on would be called aggressive act, you know, by North Vietnam against South Vietnam, and it was also to, in many respects, military, aggressive acts, you see, against South Vietnam. The United States thought it was, you know, very well justified to act militarily in Vietnam.
Okay.
The what if here is that by the time of President Kennedy, rather than President Eisenhower, would President Kennedy, you know, go into an escalation at the level that later on President Johnson did? Or would President Kennedy, who I'm sure had all the courage and profile to deal with that situation with Cuba, with Berlin, why wouldn't he take the same stand in South Vietnam? Was it because it was too far away that he could not, you know, in the eyes of the American public, say I took a very firm stand in South Vietnam, and you, and then I will really clap, you know, the North Vietnamese, you know, really hard, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth.
Well, with the failure at the Bay of Pigs, yes. in 1961, he simply, you know, it was even more imperative to his administration to make a very public, firm stance against communism, no matter where. Mm-hmm. And so there you have a commitment to Southeast Asia
yes.
in that.
So there it is still not very clear. You know, many people feel that President Kennedy would not go into 500,000 GIs there and spending hundreds of billions of dollars. But I think that if you provoke him enough, you know, eventually he would go for a very strong stand in Vietnam. See, President Kennedy. Mm-hmm. But then, fate everywhere, President Yim, President Kennedy, and then you must give credit to President Yim. He did try and set up a viable government, create a viable army in South Vietnam, you know, to deal with the with Ho Chi Minh and the Hanoi government. He did try, and he succeeded. Because if he didn't succeed, it, you know, Ho Chi Minh didn't have to, you know, really launch any attack against South Vietnam, mm-hmm. and then bring in the Americans, mm-hmm. and then the Americans, of course, reacted violently, you know, and so it was a bit disproportionate with the world public opinion. They mm-hmm. could not understand, you see. So the escalation by the North Vietnamese was much more quiet and subtle, you know, than the American intervention, but it was an escalation initiated by the North Vietnamese. You may argue that if it were at that level, you should have responded, you know, proportionally to the kind of escalation by Ho Chi Minh against South Vietnam. But I don't believe much in proportional response.
Do you think the Americans are capable of responding softly and quietly?
They thought they were doing just that, and mm-hmm. I'm sure they tried to convince the Soviet Union and the PRC that they did just that, you see, although it was, you know, in a visible manner, you know, out of proportion. But it was, in a way, you know, proportional response, which to me is just another way to put proportional accommodation. You just perpetuate the thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think many of the American generals at that time, you know, advocated that you have an all-out attack against North Vietnam, put an end to it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. One of the things that the Eisenhower administration looked at when considering how to deal with Ho Chi Minh was what happened in Munich, in Germany, and the Munich Conference. And this Munich analogy, as it's called, was, well, we, you know, as allies, appeased Hitler and said, okay, if you don't do this, then you can have this, you know, portion of Czechoslovakia, and that'll be it. And the appeasement led to World War II, is so they say. And so the Eisenhower administration looked at Ho Chi Minh and said, well, if we say, okay, you can, you know, have South Vietnam, we won't contest you there, but you can't touch Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Burma, etc. If they had worked appeasement with Ho Chi Minh, they theorized that, you know, it would be a situation just like how they treated Hitler in Munich. 1938?
Well, first of all, I find it difficult for you to trade Vietnam against Laos and Cambodia. I trade that any time. That is to keep Vietnam and give them Laos and Cambodia,
right,
rather than the other way around.
Of course. Well, Ho Chi Minh wanted his Vietnam.
Yeah,
first.
Sure.
But do you think that was a viable analogy that the United States government made?
And here you come into the debate with the Hanoi position, because you know, to play the game right at the beginning, they always claimed that they were prepared to compromise. You know, they were prepared to compromise after the Geneva Court of 1954. They were prepared to compromise again in 1960. You know, before the big escalation of the Vietnam War, if only the United States accepted some kind of a coalition, you know, in South Vietnam. In South Vietnam, not for the whole of Vietnam, but
right,
in South Vietnam,
right,
you see. And even I would say that if I were Ho Chi Minh, and if I really want to play the game with the United States, I would even offer the coalition government, as he did in 1945, for the whole of Vietnam. That would really undercut the U.S. position, you know. But then he was greedy. He just, you know, play with other people's marbles only, so in the south of Vietnam only. And they claim that they were prepared to go into a coalition government in South Vietnam by 1960, even before the Lao, you know, settlement.
Right.
So they claim that. And because they had the NLF there in 1960, and that they would be prepared. And from then, you see, they played that game till the end, till the Paris peace talks. That was the same formula, you know, under different colors and shapes, but that was the same thing. They continue, and then Dr. Kissinger, you know, play into their hands. That is to say, there's some kind of political settlement on the basis of self-determination and general elections and so on and so forth, but in South Vietnam, you know.
Yeah.
Ngo Minh Diem would claim for the whole of Vietnam. He, when he refused the general elections with the backing of the Foster Dulles, the general elections in 1956, it was because he wanted the general elections for the whole of Vietnam without the communist government in Hanoi. So he had a better position there.
Could a coalition government have survived in South Vietnam in 1960?
Well, it would have survived as much as the NLF survived in 1975 until 1976.
So the answer is no.
That's right, sure. Okay. But then the Hanoi people will, you know, claim that sure, you know, because they want to join us.
Of course. What do you think about the 1962 Geneva Accords on Laos? This came at a very crucial time in the American escalation or the American involvement in Southeast Asia.
Well, the stakes there were much lower than the conflict in Vietnam. And Ho Chi Minh, right in the 1940s, already prepared himself, or even that in the 30s, I would say, prepared himself for the whole of Indochina, you see, in order to be a viable area for him. That was why, with the French notion of Indochina, he started the Communist Party of Indochina. And he even trained the people, you know, to eventually like him, to lead in Vietnam. The Lao will lead his Lao people and the Cambodian. And he had very good two students. In Laos, they had Khe Sanh Phong Vi Hanh, and in Cambodia, they killed Song Phan, who, by the whims of history, became Khmer Rouge, because he didn't have enough time to run away from bed when the Khmer Rouge arrived. That's all. You see, and he was most educated, you know, better equipped than the other Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot to deal with the international scene. That's why he became, you know, a figure there. But Khieu Samphan was a very good student of Ho Chi Minh, and Khe Sanh Phong Vi Hanh you know very well. And so there you are, see, and the whatever settlement that you could have of Laos was not a decisive factor in the conflict. because, you know, nobody would guarantee, you know, the neutrality of Laos, and it would be there at the mercy of Ho Chi Minh.
What about the American point of view that Laos was vitally important to what was happening in Vietnam, specifically South Vietnam, because of the Ho Chi Minh Trail complex?
Of course. You see, that is again the principle of sanctuaries. Mm-hmm. As long as you play that game of sanctuaries, especially in subversive warfare, you see, you lose for sure.
Was the Canadian administration mistaken in going after neutrality in Laos, so-called neutrality in Laos?
Because at least you have some kind of peace there, you see. But they did wait much into the conflict. It was there because thanks to people living it alone, but that could be upset any time. You did not have any international force to impose that kind of a settlement there, mm-hmm. you see. And the only thing that could upset really Laos would be the PRC.
Right. You see? And that's something the United States feared.
Yeah.
Intervention of
yeah.
China.
And I found out that, after arriving in Paris, that the PRC wanted very much North Vietnam to continue the war. But for other reasons than you think. That is really to get Hanoi out of breath.
Expend their resources
yeah.
enough? So they would not ever be a threat.
Yeah, they didn't really push the North Vietnamese into negotiation. But even when in 68, or when the North Vietnamese was bright enough to go to the negotiating table with Ambassador Harriman, the Chinese still continued to push Hanoi to go on fiercer in their war activities.
Mm-hmm.
Get a more beating.
With the aims of what? Well, the goal of being what?
Weakening North Vietnam.
So they would stay, they would be a weak North Vietnam?
Sure.
Or that they would become another Chinese province?
Oh, to begin with, because the PRC did not dream right away to overtake North Vietnam and not to upset the Soviet Union.
Right.
But you have to, read into the internal problems of the PRC at that time. They were very unstable. Mao and Chu was dealing with terrible problems. Eventually you wouldn't see the Cultural Revolution and so on.
Right.
And then if you bear in mind what happened to Lam Bu, the defense minister, the Soviet Union tried very hard to take over the PRC too. Lam Bu, who was the defense minister of Mao, he was the dolphin of Mao. He was, clearly the one to succeed Mao mm-hmm. above anybody else. Why did he stage a coup and take over? And then had to run away and be shot down, in the north of China, trying to reach the Soviet Union for safety. Because he wanted, a very close, clear alliance with the Soviet Union. That is, the refusal of Mao and Chu to go Soviet way, mm-hmm. you see. There was a very strong movement from the military, especially military in China, to go the Soviet way, because that was the best base for them and to consolidate their power.
Mm-hmm.
But Mao was always pushing back the Soviet because they knew, and also Chu knew, that the Soviet, the Russians, have always been the traditional enemy of the
right.
Chinese.
Right.
And so lots of people misread that period. And even when you look and read the things about what Mao said, what Chu En Lai said to Phan Van Dong and to Ho Chi Minh and so on, you see, they said it at the tip of their tongues, those Chinese. And you must see what they were after. And then by 1960, the Chinese saw that they lost grip on Cambodia, Laos. They put their hopes on the NLF,
which wasn't very smart.
Well, because they were fooled too, and also probably you know, I was the co-president for the Friendship Vietnam-China in 1965-66. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of Chinese of Beijing in Saigon. They also misread the NLF, or wishful thinking that they would be able, you know, to take over, even if there was a very strong influence from Hanoi in the NLF ranks. Mm-hmm. But I think the Beijing people thought that they could, you know, take over, you know, provide support, mm-hmm, to the NLF and win them over to them, you know, in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And they tried very hard until the 70s. They tried hard.
Nixon goes to China in
72,
and the United States pulls out of Vietnam in 73. Do you think there was...
what happened between that period?
Well, yeah, I know.
After the overthrow of Diem in 63, and then you move to 64, the Tonkin Resolution, and then 65, the beginning really of the escalation by President Johnson to Richmond. And then the question here is, why then, in 1966, Hanoi accepted to go to Paris and sit down with the United States? Why? What pushed them to do that? They have refused to do that, you know, after 3 years of, you know, a diplomatic offensive by President Johnson, mm-hmm, to get them to the negotiating table. So why in 1968? And then, of course, after they went there, because once they have accepted to go there, they would go there only after the Tet Offensive. Mm-hmm. So it would be interesting to read that Tet Offensive too. Did the Hanoi people really, you know, hope that they could, you know, take over South Vietnam military with the U.S. Troops there, you know, or as many of the lower ranking, you know, in Hanoi and in the NNF, really hoped very strongly, including my uncles, you know, who were there on the second and third level, you know, in the hierarchy, that the people would rise up, you know, and then even with the American presence, the people would rise up, you see, and bring down the Saigon government and have a kind of coalition government with the NLF and so on and so forth.
So what role did Tet 68 play in Paris, in coming to Paris?
That is the interesting question, why Hanoi accepted to go there, you know, and then had to launch the Tet Offensive in order to go there. They always do that before they sit down at the negotiating table. That is to save face, to show their strength politically, mm-hmm, and militarily. They did that in 54 with the Nien Phu, they did that all the time, mm-hmm, even after in 72, and then, you know, the Paris Agreement and so on. So that was the principle that they adhere to, you know, 100%. That they, in the eyes of the people, they went to the negotiating table in a position of force. Mm-hmm. That the United States have to sit down and negotiate with them. That is for the ordinary people, you know, that was easy to understand. Mm-hmm. So that was the point.
Did Hanoi order the Tet Offensive, or was it more indigenous in its origins?
Yes, it was launched completely by Hanoi.
Okay. That's a controversial point in scholarship. You know, what did the Viet Cong and NLF launch that themselves without the permission from Hanoi too early, or did Hanoi give the orders?
We have lots of those tales, mm-hmm, and then lots of you know, decisions made by Hanoi at the displeasure of the NLF people and things like that. Mm-hmm. You can have that, but just for the girls, it's just for fun, you see, because the weapons, you know, came from North Vietnam. The military leaders and the commanders were really the North Vietnamese, from North Vietnam, right. You see. And then you have just a few figures militarily among the so-called Viet Cong ranks, mm-hmm, but they were not very, very bright military leaders. Madame Dinh, for example, the deputy, you know, chief of all the forces, or Jeroen Cha, you see. And so I don't I don't really believe that the MLF had an army, to begin with, mm-hmm. and then had the logistic and supplies established in order to do that thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, they use lots of those local and Viet Cong mm-hmm. people, but that would not be, sufficient to launch, the all-out attack against the Saigon army. But I'm sure, I'm more convinced that Ho Chi Minh knew very well that the Tet Offensive wouldn't topple the Saigon government or the Saigon army, and with all those American troops present there. So very clearly his objectives were elsewhere. And that's why we came to the Paris peace talks.
How much was he playing on the American public?
Very much. So if we try to analyze, and with your help maybe we understand better, from 60 to 63, overthrow of Diem. And you must say after the overthrow of Diem, it was chaotic. Mm-hmm. Chaotic. And there was a void. Whether you like it or not, Diem was some kind of a leader in South Vietnam. Not because people, thought of him as a leader, but mm-hmm. he was able to set up a country
right.
and a government and a government structures and beef up an army. You see, they are thanks to the Americans, of course, but he was able to do that. Who else could have, mm-hmm. done that? I can't see anybody, because there was nobody in his entourage who was anything near him, And there was nobody outside the Ngo-Dinh Diem government who were of any stature to be a leader. And if you consider the one at the top of the MLF, lawyer Nguyen Hữu Thọ, he was not a kind of a leader. An intellectual, yes. Well known, yes. But he would not be a kind of a leader to face Ho Chi Minh. I doubt that much.
But did anybody have a chance against Ho Chi Minh?
I don't think so. And then afterwards, you see, 2 years of a so-called civilian government mm-hmm. To please President Johnson. you had to return to military rule. If you compare, what we had the Second Republic of Vietnam compared to the First Republic of Vietnam, in terms of the intellect, philosophy, and the policies put out to the people, the period of Minh Thieu was a complete void compared to Ho Dinh Diem. Although he had his Catholicism, but there was something. But, with Thieu and all the Saigon Germans, there was nothing at all to give to the peasants, except anti-communism.
Right.
That's all. See.
And they didn't
that was a big boy.
They didn't understand that.
Of course. I mean, as I said to you, I asked them what is nationalist, because I always brandished the flag of nationalism. They said that a nationalist is an anti-communist. That's all. The answer you have. That was a big point.
Want to take a break?
Yes.
Okay. This is Richard Varon, and I'm continuing the oral history interview with Ambassador Fong, and we're joined by Jimmy Board this morning. It is October 23rd, about 9:12 a.m. Sir, I have a couple of questions I would like to follow up on. We had spent a little time in our last session discussing President Diem and his tenure, and a couple of clarifying questions. One, discussing the coup that took him out of office. One of the questions that Americans have, and this continues, and we've talked about this before in this interview, but I think it does need some more fleshing out, is how much involvement the Americans had in the coup. And the specific question is concerning, we know we have the transcripts of the telephone conversations. We know the so-called official contacts between the American embassy and Prime Minister Zim. And what do you know of any records of conversations that the Americans had with the generals who took over, or the people who came into power? Do you know of any other conversations that the public is not aware of, or that really hasn't come to light about that coup?
Well, it's very difficult now to have a clear picture of what happened.
Yes.
But there were, I'm sure that we can agree, clear forces or motivations by various parties at that time. That is, by the end of 1962 and then beginning 1963. I think that Zim's performance up to that time became worse and worse. And it was the impression of many people that that poor performance resulted from the very harsh measures taken by his brother Ngu, who was responsible for the security and rather for the political aspects of the whole conflict. So, on the one hand, Zim and Ngu were not very able to cope with the increasing, subversive actions by the North Vietnamese and by the so-called Viet Cong. And it was at that time also, in 1959-1960, that you had the beginning of opposition in South Vietnam to the Ngo Dinh Diem regime, which became more and more repressive and more dictatorial. So here we may mention, for example, the Caravelle Group, which included many prominent, South Vietnamese personalities, who were very close to people like Nguyen Ngoc Thọ and all other, who joined Trần Đình Thảo and Dương Quỳnh Hoa and Ngô Bá Thành, who then they joined the NLF and formed the NLF with the help of the Hanoi government. Mm-hmm. But there were others who were in Saigon, in South Vietnam, who were very dissatisfied with the performance of President Zim and his brother Ngu. And then that, shall we say, dissatisfaction was also very clear to the Americans who were there. And they tried very much to bring Zim back to the right track, if we may say so. But Zim was not very, shall we say, sensitive to the recommendations of the U.S. Embassy and of the U.S. advisors and so on. And there was a clear conflict, between Zim and the American, policies. Action there. It came to the point that, as always, when the American government was dissatisfied with the local government there, you had the threat of the reduction or of the cutting of American aid. You see. And at that time, we must also remember that with his mouth, Michelian mind, Ngo Dinh Diem trying to find other issues or solutions to their situation. And that was the beginning of his contact through the diplomats in Saigon and through the International Control and Supervision Commission of the 1954 Geneva Accords to get contacts with the Hanoi authorities. And that became known also that he tried to compose with the Hanoi authority because he was faced with the possibility that the U.S. may not support him and President Diem anymore. And then his attempt also at that time with the French government to get the support or help and aid from the French, and the French were not in position to help much. Mm-hmm. So that was the situation. See, there was very clearly a need to have reforms with the Ngodingim regime. And it is claimed now that the CIA was not aware of the preparations of that coup against him, that they say did not know the details of the operations to overthrow him. But it cannot be denied that the CIA coming was aware that there was something going on, mm-hmm. and there was a coup in preparation, mm-hmm. supposedly to be by Big Min and the Saigon generals. Mm-hmm. And the Saigon generals, the prominent ones at that time was Trong Van Dong, Tung Thuc Dinh, Le Van Kim, Mai Hu Xuân. These were the elder generals, you know, compared to, for example, Thieu, who was at that time only a colonel, and Ki was at that time only a lieutenant colonel, or even not even major or something. Mm-hmm. See, so. That was the situation. It cannot be denied that the CIA was aware that there was a coup. But we have come to accept now that the CIA was not informed of the details of the coup. And Jean Dong, when I saw him in Paris later, before he died, he claimed that the CIA did not know the details of the coup. See? But the CIA was very much aware that the coup was there.
What's going to happen? How about the American ambassador? How much the embassy staff, were they, the diplomats, were they aware that a coup was in the process or was brewing?
I think compared to the CIA, you see, the embassy, officials were even less informed, mm-hmm. and Ambassador Lodge, I think, till the end, claimed that he was not aware of the details of the coup, but he knew very well that the coup was very prominent, mm-hmm. and repeatedly he called President Yim on the phone to offer, right. you know, that the U.S. Embassy may give him a safety mm-hmm. Exit from sight.
Why didn't he take that?
Well, I don't think it it was in the personality of President Yim to leave the country or run away. He was not that kind of person. He would try and find a way out, and he was sure that in the end it would turn out all right, because in the very end he thought that the Saigon generals, who were really, his products, mm-hmm. Would in the end, accept some kind of compromise mm-hmm. with him, and wouldn't go as far as to kill him.
Right. Yes. So you don't think he expected to be killed?
Not at all.
He would have. Where do you? If he was going to stay in Vietnam and thought he was not going to be killed, where do you think he saw himself In the future Saigon government?
I think that after his stay in the United States, he may have come to, convince himself that the U.S. government would never, kill him, mm-hmm. Even in a coup. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, he wouldn't think that the Saigon generals would come to that point. You see? And so he was very confident that even in the last minute, he would be able to have some compromise with the Saigon generals, although he tried very hard to bring back the army units which he thought would remain loyal to him, mm-hmm. and when he decided to surrender in the Cha Tam church in Chinatown, it is in my opinion very clear it was that he did not think that they would kill him. If not, he wouldn't have surrendered. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But he did not, I think. It did not cross his mind that the Saigon generals were already, set to kill his brother, Ngô Đình Diệm. And it is more and more the generally accepted version now that Bittman did give orders on the half of the military junta there to kill Nguyen, because Nguyen was really bad. So Captain Nguyen got probably the instructions to kill Nguyen, you see. And on the way back from Chinatown, the Chatham church to the headquarters of the RVN near Tan Sien Nhat, when the M113 passed by the Olympic garage, that was the time that Captain Nguyen, you know, opened fire with a submachine gun on Nguyen. And we are all inclined to believe that at that moment, President Nguyen thought that he could save his brother by trying to protect him, and he threw himself over his brother, thinking probably that Captain Nguyen would not fire on him. But Captain Nguyen then fired on both. So that was how Big Minh then explained to Colonel Thieu that it was accidental suicide. That's what the terms that Big Minh used.
Right. What do you believe happened in that AVV?
I think that they had the intention to kill Nguyen, because he was a really, you know, very cruel man. And then accidentally, I'm sure, President Nguyen was killed.
What role did Madame Nguyen really play in the government? What kind of influence does she have over her husband? And
yeah, she had an enormous influence. First of all, because President Nguyen was a bachelor, so she had the role of the first lady. And then she also tried to organize her the groups, the women's solidarity movement. And then she led, you know, all the big programs related to women and children, family life, and so on and so forth. It was through her that, for example, with the very strong religious convictions based on Catholicism, in Roman Catholics, divorce was forbidden. In Vietnam, that whole period. So, but then it was also clear in the general public, in the cities, and especially Saigon, that she was very intelligent. She was always scheming something. And of course, it was necessary many instances to go through her to get things done in Saigon. Much easier to go through Madame Nguyen than to go and see President Nguyen or Advisor Nguyen. So then it was also the traditional, you know, Eastern way, Oriental way to do things, you know, to talk to the wives rather, get things done.
She was, you know, very Catholic. Did she not realize that imposing Catholic-type laws and rules on a Buddhist population was not going to work?
There, you see, we have to go into the details.
Okay.
Because when you use the term Buddhist in Vietnam, it's a very loose term.
Okay.
It's not, a, shall we say, a very active and concrete form of religion. Buddhism in Vietnam came from China, which received it from India for thousands of years, and it was very mingled with Confucianism. That is to say, it became part of our traditions and customs. And as I would say that most Vietnamese are not very conscious of Buddhism as a religion. But it's a way of life, and it is, of course, religious in the sense that it answers the needs that you have for the spiritual life. But that was probably the reason why Yim and then Madame Nguyen were not much concerned about that Buddhist aspect in the Vietnamese society, because it was not really a religious thing, you know. in the minds of the great majority of the Vietnamese. And on the other hand, there was clearly an effort on the part of Diem, New, and Madame New, mm-hmm. To infuse Western thinking and values, mm-hmm. As part of an effort to modernize the Vietnamese society, mm-hmm. To bring progress to the Vietnamese society. And so the clash there was not really on Buddhism, but it was clearly a clash against the traditions and customs of the Vietnamese people.
Okay.
I think that was the mistake that they made.
You said earlier in our discussions that you did not think that there was a viable replacement for President Nguyen. What about people from the Caravelle group? Was there anybody there who could possibly step in besides the generals to take over the political reins of Saigon?
Well, first, the Caravelle group was rather the intelligentsia, mm-hmm. Of the Saigon people. And in there, to begin with, you had Dr. Phan Van Do. Dr. Phan Van Do was the uncle of Madame Nguyen, because Dr. Do was the younger brother of lawyer Tran Van Chuong, who was the Diem's ambassador in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Do was also the foreign minister representing South Vietnam at the 1954 Geneva Accords. And there you also had Dr. Nguyen Lu Vien, who was the medical doctor, who was director of the Pasteur Institute, so a very respectable chap. And then you had many other prominent lawyers, mm-hmm. and university professors and so on, very respectable people, who sent a very long letter to President Nguyen, analyzing all the aspects of his regime, political, economic, social, etc., and security and so on, and said that he was going, towards catastrophe. Many of them were arrested right away. The others were so prominent that Nguyen didn't arrest, and also relatives of the Ngodin Nguyen family too. But we have to bring it back into its proper context. Diem tried to set up a state in South Vietnam after the Geneva Accords. Whether you like it or not, it's a kind of an artificial state, although that will become a very sensitive point even during the Paris negotiations. And there was a point of vital point discussed between Thieu and Kissinger, mm-hmm. The end, because they trying to cling to the legitimacy of a South Vietnam as a state, mm-hmm. compared to the North Vietnam, Democratic Republic of Vietnam, as a state too. Mm-hmm. See, and so was it very obvious in the large majority of the Vietnamese in South Vietnam that you should have a country called South Vietnam? You may call it the State of Vietnam, or you may call it Republic of Vietnam, you see. I am not convinced that the people in South Vietnam, were very conscious that there was a state called South Vietnam. Most of those people, the peasants, the countryside, they continue to think Vietnam as one, mm-hmm. whatever you may say. And that is also a basic element in the conflict, because Ho Chi Minh never tried to push up very hard on that notion of two Vietnams. He rather clung to the idea that he had a Vietnam, a North Vietnam called the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and that was supposed to be Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He didn't say that I am just North Vietnam. He never said that. It was not stupid to say such a
thing. It's very clever of him to do that way.
And I think that is the very basic thing in the whole Vietnam conflict, till the very end. Whether you were, you know, in a position to convince the Vietnamese in South Vietnam that you were defending the country there. Very hard to say. So it was handicapped. And so, right at the beginning, I think Ngô Đình Diệm had that handicap. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing left for him to do except, you know, try to play with the 1954 Geneva Accords and claim, if not de jure, you have the fatal, mm-hmm. you know, state of two Vietnams there. Mm-hmm. And then you were on a defensive position again, because according to the 1954 Geneva Accords, you must proceed to the general elections. And that's the position taken by Ho Chi Minh, you know, demanding general elections all the time. Yeah. And you then had the position of refusing, you know, those general elections. Mm-hmm. And that was the American position too, mm-hmm. just the first Dallas. So to begin with, you have to put it back in its you know, proper context there. And so President Diem had a very hard job to create a state, mm-hmm. to set up a government, because when the French left and the last units of French forces left in 1956, so at that time he must you know, fill in the void left by the French,
right.
And he relied on the one hand, you know, the administrative structures and the civil servants trained and left by the French there. And on the other hand, he had to try and take away that French influence, French taste, you know, in the South Vietnamese society, and replace it more and more by what people considered the American, you know, mm-hmm. system, mm-hmm. To replace the French system in South Vietnam.
But that was a problem, right?
So he didn't get the win-win situation. He had the lose-lose situation, because to replace the French by an American image, you know, that was no plus, mm-hmm. you know, for the Vietnamese in South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But he tried, you see, he tried. So that was his problem. And you must give credit to Diem too, that he was able, you know, through the methods of Mandarin, you know, to set up an administrative machinery in South Vietnam, and he was able to run, you know, South Vietnam in opposition to North Vietnam. And one of the great things that he did was the National School of Administration, to form those civil servants, mm-hmm. very much in the French way, but more and more on the American concept. And he had, you know, great help there from the Michigan State University, mm-hmm. which literally run, you know, his educational policies. The MSU was everywhere in Saigon, you know, in the education field. And also then to continue with the military academies left by the French, but more and more with the American advisors moving in to right. train them, right. and sending also lots of officers to the United States for training. So he was able to set up an army and a government. And the interesting question here has bothered me forever, that did he, President Diem, have any other choice on the chessboard? Mm-hmm. Ho Chi Minh saw that very well, that with the help of the Americans you will set up a kind of a state there, a government there, an army there. And the only thing for Ho Chi Minh to do was to begin the escalation in trying to bring down that government and that army, that state from the Republic of Vietnam. And was it possible for Ngô Đình Diệm to up any other alternatives but to respond to that escalation, because during 55 and 60 the escalation was mainly subversive actions, and we can have the figures there, thousands and thousands, tens and thousands of the village chiefs, of the, you know, those people from these administrative structures who were literally assassinated, and Harris and all kinds of things. So there was nothing left for him but to respond to that with more repressive actions against communism in his mind.
Right. Which in turn hurt him in the long run.
Because, I mean, the communism, the Ho Chi Minh was very clever to mingle it with the nationalism and with the upsurge of, you know, nationalistic feelings of the Vietnamese in South Vietnam. So you can't make the difference anymore. And the more repressive action you take against communism, the more repressive action you impose on the people themselves.
Right.
So what was the choice offered to him at that time? You know, that is 1960 to 1962. That was a very crucial thing for him to do.
Let's talk about the army that was formed, Arvin, and the American advisors. Arvin has been widely criticized for being inept, being cowards, some people have said, for not being able to defend their own country. Why such harsh criticism of Arvin? Where did it go wrong, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, you set up an army to fight the wrong war.
Right.
Because Hanoi didn't launch a conventional war against South Vietnam, and you set up a conventional army to deal with it. But that conventional army, Ho Chi Minh knew very well that if you use it, it will be against the people, because not against the regular North Vietnamese divisions. There was none at that time. And so they will use that army to provide what I call territorial security.
Okay.
Territorial security is not done by the army, it's done by the police. So which you call the civil guards, or you call, you know, self-defense forces and so on and so forth. But you don't have, you know, a million, you know, regular army troops to provide territorial security. You know, it's like now, you know, in the cities of New York or Washington, you have the army doing the work of the police. So that was, the conception was wrong right at the beginning.
Do you think that, was that the Americans' fault for training, setting up an army in that way, or?
Very clearly.
Okay.
Very clearly, because I think that in the 1950s, you know, after the Geneva Accords, and then in the early 1960s, I doubt very much that the people in Washington, in the Pentagon, and in the White House had any idea what was kind of war they were dealing with. Because at that time, I think between 1955 and 60, even Ho Chi Minh didn't have any idea of what kind of war he was going to launch against South Vietnam. And eventually, he devised that kind of form of fighting, you know. So, to begin with, to say that the Arvin was not apt, you know, to fight the Vietnam War, at the very beginning the concept was, you know, erroneous. The second aspect was that the attitude or the morale of the Arvin troops, what kind of morale can you infuse into those people, you know, who were asked to fight a war, expected to fight a war of aggression from North Vietnam, and you keep on, you know, putting in their heads that they have to fight an armed aggression from North Vietnam. But in the end, they did not have much opportunity to fight that aggression, armed aggression from North Vietnam, through conventional war.
Right.
You see, and there were eventually, with that kind of logic, you end up with just a few crack units. The airborne, the tanks, and all the crack units, when there were some kind of conventional warfare, you know, here and there, the big battles, they did very well. Those crack units of Saigon, the Arvin, did very well because they were trained to do those things. You know, but to provide territorial security, they failed completely. They can't do that, you see. And then the million troops that you have there, many of them was just, you know, on paper. We knew that, you know. Mm-hmm. And the young guys were drafted, and then they were put then in the villages, the districts, and the hamlets there, mm-hmm. so going to provide territorial security. Mm-hmm. And they didn't do anything at all. Many of them just stayed home and then gave their pay to the commanding officers they had, you see. And so you had figures, statistics, but not really any fighting, you know, force. And then the big battles were done by the crack units, and they did very well. And many of the American advisors and American officers would, you know, testify to that, that when they were with those crack units, the army crack units, they did very well, and they showed that at the Tet Offensive, they showed that in, again in 1972 with the big Spring Offensive, they did very well.
How do you think the Americans could convince, or anybody could convince, a South Vietnamese individual, or I guess a Vietnamese individual in the South, to fight against, you, as you say, his brother enemy, another Vietnamese person from the northern part of the country? Was that feasible to try to convince them that these other Vietnamese, your brethren, are your enemy, and so you must kill them, you must fight them, and this is why, because of democracy and because of freedom and this, and defending your country, when like you correctly pointed out that, you know, there were very few Pavan incursions into South Vietnam in a conventional way. How difficult was it to convince them to fight their fellow Vietnamese?
To understand that, I think it would be better to put the question the other way around.
Okay.
That is to say, why was Ho Chi Minh able to motivate his troops mm-hmm. and his people in North Vietnam to fight the Vietnamese in South Vietnam? Mm-hmm. He had a big fight in South Vietnam. I'm sure he was aware that the Vietnamese in South Vietnam were not motivated in any way to fight the North the North Vietnamese people too. You see, Vietnamese in North Vietnam, mm-hmm. and so this becomes the strategic element in the modern type of warfare. It was very political. And so he chose the position to motivate the people in North Vietnam and also in South Vietnam to fight against foreign intervention. You see, in that context, historical context, after the Second World War, and he had there, I'm sure, a win-win situation in both North and South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You see. So that was easier for him compared to Diem.
There was no foreign aggressor from the South to fight against.
Yes. And so the more foreign intervention you put in, the more handicap you have in South Vietnam. You see? And that it was then how he managed to motivate, you know, the North Vietnamese to fight on and on and on. And the sacrifices that he put on the North Vietnamese population was enormous compared to the South Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. So, to answer your question, I think that it was possible for Ho Chi Minh to play on that upsurge of nationalistic feelings and the fight against foreign presence, foreign rule, then for Ngo Dinh Diem, you know, to motivate the Vietnamese in South Vietnam to fight against so-called armed aggression by North Vietnam, which was, in the mind of many people in South Vietnam, completely fictitious.
Right.
So politically, you lose them.
Do you think the Arvin officers, the people who worked directly with the American advisors, were resentful toward the Americans coming in and trying to set up a new military system and give this so-called advice to them?
I think, first of all, it's really human that in human relations you have frictions like that, mm-hmm. especially with the military, mm-hmm. who were very proud of themselves, you know, and in the tradition of, especially the Eastern tradition, mm-hmm. of the warriors and the fighters. Many of those Saigon generals were French trained, and then they were at that time transform into, you know, American train in order to continue with the kind of government that President Kim tried to set up in South Vietnam. So there was a big transition there, you know, from the French military tradition to the American military tradition. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you can see there is a big difference between the two military traditions there. And we are talking here about the professional soldiers.
Right.
Just a very small number of people. And that would come down to the most, I would say, to the level of a captain or major. Below that, they had no notion of, you know, French or American military traditions at all. And they were just drafted. They just went into the army and just sat there. But for the generals, your question then would concern the way of fighting, you know, and the kind of army that you're trying to set up. And so with President Kim, I think they continue with a very conventional and traditional concept of an army, very conventional army, you see. There was, attempts or efforts to set up units to find some kind of guerrilla warfare, subversive right. activities. But they did not understand, you know, that kind of subversive action mm-hmm. taken by the enemies. Mm-hmm. It was not strictly guerrilla warfare, subversive action, but it was a very clever mixture of political, of subversive, of traditional, conventional, you know, action mm-hmm. against the Republic of Vietnam. And when you use, you know, those pacification cadres to deal with subversion, then the enemy would try to use other types of action against them, mm-hmm. and they can launch, you know, very, should we say, conventional, you know, attacks against those teams. Mm-hmm. But then, when you use conventional units to fight your enemy, then they will retreat and use subversive action, and you have to go and search and destroy and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so, the conception that they had for the military activities in South Vietnam were really, you know, inept, not appropriate mm-hmm. with the type of action taken by the enemy.
How could they get it so wrong? These military officers, American and Vietnamese, who were not dumb people, how could they get that so wrong, do you think?
It is not really military. I think it's very much political and psychological, okay. you know, because they thought that they had all the rights in the world to claim self-defense.
Right.
And that I didn't do anything against you in North Vietnam. Why do you come in South Vietnam, you know, and, you know, attack me? Mm-hmm. I have all the right in the world to be left alone. And so that was also, I think, the general attitude, not only of the population who wanted to be left alone before taking side ideologically, you know, mm-hmm. communists or not communists, or anti-communists mm-hmm. and so on, but to be left alone. So they thought that, you know, that that point of decency would be strong enough to have the world to support them, and that the world would tell the Americans with all its their might would say to Hanoi, but leave the poor guy alone, you know. But then, of course, Ho Chi Minh wouldn't leave them alone, right. And that was, I think, the attitude. They couldn't understand why, you know, those people in North Vietnam would use, you know, very deadly measures against them and attack them, you know, so blatantly. Mm-hmm. because in the end they were not motivated to fight their brother enemies, really. There was no justification for them to do that. And they would be prepared to sit down and listen to the North Vietnamese...
Sir, I'm almost out of time here. Let me change this disc. Okay, sir. I wanted to talk about the will of the North Vietnamese people. One criticism of the American government has been that the American government simply underestimated the will of the Vietnamese people, specifically the will of the North Vietnamese people, to sustain such long-term difficulty in their life, that the escalation that Johnson put on the country would finally make them break, but he and others in the government simply underestimated.
Well, I think from the outside, if you look into that period, you would say that the North Vietnamese had a collective will in our determination in their fight for what they believe in, compared to the South Vietnamese, you see, and particularly the Ha Vinh troops. I don't think that it was a matter of will. It would be nearer to the thinking of the Vietnamese that first of all you must believe in what you do. And so the North, the people in North Vietnam were clearer in their mind of what they were doing. That is to say, they were fighting against foreign intervention, foreign presence, foreign rule, etc. And that was also the position they took in order to motivate the Vietnamese in South Vietnam. So to begin with, President Nguyen was with a big handicap to begin with, politically and psychologically. And then when you say the will, I would put it in other terms. I don't think that the Vietnamese, either in North Vietnam or in South Vietnam, lack or did not lack the will, but it was rather an attitude that they had in that conflict. And so they believe in something, and with that belief, that is to say, to fight against foreign intervention, foreign presence, foreign rule, and they did the best that they could with the means and the abilities that they had. And then when they saw the tremendous escalation in the use of the means of war, you know, by President Johnson in the 1960s, it was not a question, I think, of the will to go on, because in face of such an escalation, the magnitude, you know, the intensity of that war, it was rather a kind of resignation rather than will.
Resignation.
That is to say, you have done your best, you know, in the fight for your country, for your people, and now, I mean, it cannot be worse. I know. You know, just sit and take the beating. And it came to our, you know, awareness that the pain sustained by the Americans in the Vietnam War was much more than the kind of pain that the Vietnamese, you know, had to endure, although the casualties were a thousand times more, but they were able to sustain that pain much more than the Americans. They were less, shall we say, affected, you know, by the level of suffering and pain.
Why is that? Is that an Eastern philosophy?
Yes, I think it is a very Eastern attitude, an Eastern philosophy. That is, they have a high degree or high ability of sustaining pain and sufferings, you know, in silence.
What about the notion of defending your country against foreign intervention? That
produces
a lot of resignation.
Yes, but then you see, you come to a point when you have nothing else to do. I mean, you did your maximum already. What else can you do? In that fight, and that was the same attitude too for the Vietnamese in South Vietnam. I think they came to the point that they had the impression that they did the maximum already, and that the conflict was too big for them to understand, to cope with. You know, what could have Arvin, done more, even with all the help of the U.S. government. They came to a point that they couldn't do anything more. And then the enemy was still there, continue to put up the fight with it.
What about the Viet Cong? First of all, were they, do you think, in your opinion, do you think that they were indigenous to South Vietnam, or was it a northern-fueled movement?
Well, here I think we have to be honest with ourselves. There were opposition to the Ngo Dinh Diem regime, and later probably to the Nguyễn Văn Thiệu era. Many people were, against those administrations. But that would not say, that would not justify for you to join the Hanoi government. Mm-hmm. To overthrow your government in South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So that is one point, you see. Were there no other choice? For example, the Karen group, they did not go to the NLF,
right.
You see.
Right.
So there was a movement of opposition, political opposition, to the Saigon government. But that does not mean, you see, that you join the enemy, to overthrow your own government.
Mm-hmm.
See? That is to say, would you play the democratic game of trying to change your form government, in a peaceful way, mm-hmm. and not declare war to your government? But many, I'm sure, were tempted in South Vietnam to go to war, and because there was already a war going on, and it was, the justifications were already, put forth by Ho Chi Minh and the Hanoi government, that you have to overthrow the government in South Vietnam instead of playing the democratic rule, in South Vietnam. So there you have to make a distinction there, you see, between people who were really dissatisfied with the Saigon government and the performance of President Diem and so on, afterwards with President Nguyen Văn Thiệu, up to a point that then you have to join the enemy lines, like the NLF.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can also say, I think honestly, that the NLF by itself would not survive. Not possible. No logistics, nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have joined the fight, that way you have joined the enemy forces. And so no more distinction there. It's academic to see whether, after that, the NLF is purely South Vietnamese or not, because mm-hmm. That's you join in the two sides of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so to say that there was a movement of opposition mm-hmm. in South Vietnam, among the people in South Vietnam, against their own government in South Vietnam, from there to cross the line and say that you have to join the North Vietnamese forces and fight against the government of inside on that, that's two completely different things.
Okay. Would you like to take a short break?
Yes,
yeah,
sure.
Okay. Sir, we've been talking about a little bit about the Viet Cong, and that brings up the strategic ammo program that the United States and the South Vietnamese government tried to implement in South Vietnam to control the population, to pacify the population. What can you say about the strategic ammo program? And it was a disaster in the end.
To begin with, you see that there's a contradiction in terms. When we use that, we try to control the population mm-hmm. and then to pacify the population.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I think we run into the problem of, you know, how to understand, how to conceive that kind of conflict, which started then after the Second World War for the Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. And so with President Nguyen, eventually the overwhelming issue for him and for the American authorities were to provide security to the people in South Vietnam in face of the subversive actions carried out by North Vietnam against South Vietnam. And we saw that that Ho Chi Minh and his group started the whole thing on very, shall we say, sound basis. Mm-hmm. That is to say, to fight against foreign rule, presence, intervention, and to regain national sovereignty, independence, and so on for the Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. So, right at the beginning, 1955, when Ngo Dinh Diem started to set up a country called the Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam, mm-hmm. with its army, its government, its administrative structures, and so on, he assumed then the responsibility to provide security for the people in South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of Ho Chi Minh and his group is to disrupt that kind of government, mm-hmm. that kind of administrative structure, and also to demonstrate to the Vietnamese people that Ngo Dinh Diem and the American would not be in position, you know, to provide them with that security, and also did not have the justification to impose such government or such administrative structures on the people in South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So you started with that context. Mm-hmm. And more with the disruption, subversive actions created by Ho Chi Minh and his group from North Vietnam, the more we saw that very harsh repressive measures, you know, had to be taken by President Nguyen, mm-hmm. to provide that so-called security, mm-hmm. to the people in South Vietnam. And one of the ways that they thought would be to set up those strategic hamlets or Acroville and so on in South Vietnam. I think the idea came to Nguyen rather than to President Nguyen. And probably the idea also came from the Sir Robert Thompson, the British, because he was much more inclined to listen to the British than to the American at that time.
Nguyen was.
Nguyen was. Mm-hmm. See, more and more he became very apprehensive of the Americans.
Why?
Because
so?
They didn't seem to agree with a number of things that he was doing. So he tried to introduce that idea in order to provide security, mm-hmm. to the people in South Vietnam. And he was very impressed, as I was able to understand, with the kibbutz in Israel. But then the kibbutz in Israel were very different from what Nguyen, you know, tried to set up in South Vietnam. That is to say, you had people who were willing to fight to defend their ways of life, to defend their properties, their own properties. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you can go in the field, plow, and wear the rifle at the same time and defend yourself. Mm-hmm. That was a very natural, spontaneous reaction for people in Israel to do that, mm-hmm. because that land was very precious to them. They came back to that promised land. Yes. And they were, you know, highly motivated to do that. Mm-hmm. It was not really something that the government imposed on the people to do. They did it by themselves. But the kind of security that Nguyen tried to bring to the Vietnamese in South Vietnam was completely conditioned by the form of warfare that North Vietnam imposed on South Vietnam. He did not have the initiative. he responded, you know, to the disruption, to the subversive action taken by North Vietnam against South Vietnam in those years of the late 1950s and the beginning of the 1960s. So, what did he do? To begin with, he didn't have much means to do that and rely very much on U.S. aid at that time, which came, you know, very little. They were much more interested at that time in Washington to beef up the army rather, and also to help set up the government structures, how to administer, and they were not very conscious yet of that kind of fight, you know, launched on them by North Vietnam. So they did not go into much economic say reforms or measures to help the South Vietnamese. It was left to President Diem to find out. So Nhu was very aware that he had to provide some security to the people in the villages, and then also to demonstrate that his kind of government and ideology, personalism, that they tried to put across to the Vietnamese in South Vietnam would bring more prosperity, better life, you know, to the people in the countryside. So here again, I think they were completely in the dark, you know, about the type of fight, struggle, or war, you know, against, you know, North Vietnam. And they try very hard to help the villagers, you know, to get a kind of security in order to work on their land and to have a prosperous life there. And so the term that they used at the very beginning was the prosperous zones, you know, Khu Tô Mập, prosperous zones. That is the home zones there where you can have your crops and you have your life there and so on. But then, you see, as I said, they didn't have the initiative in that kind of conflict with Ho Chi Minh, because the other side just tried to disrupt that kind of secure and prosperous life that you hope to bring to the Vietnamese in the countryside in South Vietnam. So in the end, you had what we call the wars of barbed wires and concrete. That is to say, in order to provide that kind of so-called security to the villagers, and you just put barbed wire around them, you know, or put concrete around them. And at one time, I think Westmoreland was very keen on concrete too. That is to have fortifications, outposts. Then you would put your regular soldiers all around in order to provide security. And then when it was not, you know, very, shall we say, tight, then you put the barbed wire. So that was the time of the millionaires and barbed wire. Barbed wire everywhere. So what was then the effects on the people? What were then the reactions of the people when you put them behind barbed wires?
Wasn't that a little like the French outpost system?
That's it.
You see? Know, putting these...
Exactly the same. And you still have those things now as historical sites in South Vietnam. And so, more and more, you put people behind barbed wires. But you cannot just imagine, even with the kibbutz in Israel, to put barbed wires. You cannot do that, you see. So when you put up the barbed wire, what you try to do is that when during the day, we may have the Arvin patrolling around there and provide some security for you to work in the fields. But at night, it wouldn't be safe to be outside. So let us go all inside the hamlets and put up the barbed wires. So how would you feel if you were the peasants there? You disrupt completely their lives, you know, completely. And then what kind of psychological warfare that the other side would use? See? First of all, they would say that the barbed wire is put up there, you know, to, shall we say, imprison you, which was not very far from truth. That disrupted your, you know, regular, normal life completely. But then, because you were told it would be safer to get inside that, you know, barbed wire, than to remain outside during the night. There were, of course, other people who refused to go into inside the barbed wire, and in that case, they had to go elsewhere. And then the Viet Cong would move in, the North Vietnamese would move in to say, well, go to the liberated zones. Although there was no liberated zones, you know, but they claim that you can go to the non-pacified areas, which would be claimed as liberated zones, you see. But then, as you see, the army can could move anywhere, go anywhere, and retake those positions, you know. But then you had that notion of the liberated zones, of the zones which were not under the Saigon government administration. So that is another, shall we say, element which came into play with the population there. See. And then for those people who accepted to go inside the barbed wires, eventually they were made to understand that you have joined the Saigon side if you go inside the barbed wires, see. So you're sold to the foreign, you know, power, traitors to your fatherland. And that was then later the justification for the Viet Cong, and even when the North Vietnamese troops invaded Hue and Quang Tri in 1972, that they presented a picture of justification to exterminate people who took the side of the Saigon government. Hundreds and thousands of people. You know. And that was also what I call the dialectics of terror. That is to say, to impress on the ordinary people, the population, that you should not be on the side of the Saigon government. And in that case, be on the side of the American imperialists and so on. So they had their political stand, they have their psychological motivations, what they play, you know, against what you call at that very start the strategic hamlets. And their strategic hamlets have never succeeded in any way, because whatever you do, it can be disrupted very easily, you see. So you try to provide a kind of security, which was no security, because with the concrete and with the barbed wires, then the enemy used the rockets. They didn't have to send in the troops. They did not have to have troops into the strategic hamlets. But then it was a reign of terror for the people inside those strategic hamlets to receive rockets at any time. And that was really a terrifying thing for the ordinary population to receive the Viet Cong rockets. And that was used not to destroy their strategic hamlets, but to impress on the mind of the people, and that the Saigon government would never be in a position to provide you the security that they claim.
Do you think that instead of the Agravilles and strategic hamlet program, that if the Saigon government had left the villagers to themselves, let the Viet Cong continue with attacks and harassment and terrorist activities, that psychologically villages would have come over to the Saigon government side naturally, because the government would say, we're not doing this. This is the Viet Cong. This is your enemy doing this.
The problem which appeared to me at that time, even in 1960, mm-hmm. you know, I work on in my mind that because we were so obsessed by the military aspects of mm-hmm. the conflict, mm-hmm. and when with the escalation of the war activities, even in the conventional sense, that the Washington and Saigon were so obsessed with the aspect of the war, which was on the high level through very conventional means. And then at the same time you had a very essential political struggle, mm-hmm. you see, which had nothing to do with the conventional war, but much more on the well-being, the normal ways of life of the people, mostly in the countryside. So that was the dilemma, I think, of the Ngo Dinh Diem and afterwards. That is, they did not commit enough means in providing the people, you know, with the ways of making a living by themselves. They try to, shall we say, almost dispense, you know, aid to the people who receive it as charity, mm-hmm. you know. And that was the later part of the strategic famines, that people were there waiting for government aids to come to them. You know, they did not have any motivation to defend anything because nothing belonged to them. Mm-hmm. You know, and so there, to answer your question, I think that you have to resolve here a fundamental economic problem. Not to bring aid to the people, you know, as mm-hmm. they used to have, mm-hmm. you know, with USAID, mm-hmm. but how to provide the people with the means for them to organize themselves, to have the possibility, you know, to develop, you know, their own activities. Mm-hmm. See? So you run into very big problems. And they were aware of those problems. First of all, you have agrarian land reform. That is to say, you must try and make the people feel they own their land. It's their own land that they are defending. Mm-hmm. And Diem was very aware of it. Thieu was very aware of it. And USAID was also very aware of it. But they didn't do anything much about that. That is to say, bring back the land to the people. Mm-hmm. See, they did have programs, but it was just for the show. It did not really get into the people. Those agrarian reforms, they call it land reform. Mm-hmm. So that is the first basic element. The second basic element, and here I give you an anecdote.
Okay.
In 1960, when I just returned from England, and for some reason, unknown reason, one day I received a visit from a lieutenant in the Saigon Army. He said that he came on behalf of Advisor New. You see? Mm-hmm. And Advisor New would like me to give a talk on the economy, mm-hmm. because they loved that I was trained in economics. And since I just returned, I would have, you know, fresh ideas mm-hmm. to give them. I said, well, you have lots of, you know, very well-known professors in economics like Professor Hatton, Professor Took, you know, who were the crack economists of Saigon at that time. And I was told that I could choose my subject, the topic, you see. He said, all right, let me think a few days. Mm-hmm. Then the following week I gave my reply. I said, I can give a talk on the grocery shop in my maternal village, Ba Tri. Mm-hmm. Ba Tri is a very well-known village because they have always been, you know, the seat of insurgency and so on against the French and so on. And so most of them said that, you know, I'm not serious. I was not serious to take such a topic. I said, no, I'm very serious. And here I give you that example because I found out in my maternal village, the native village of my mother, that grocery shop, which has existed for generations, it's just a grocery shop owned by a Chinese family. I've been there for six or seven generations or something, together with the family of my mother there. And day and night it's open. I've been there, see. And they knew everybody in the village, of course. And the guy was always there, very prepared to serve you at any time of day and night. You need a liter of lamping oil to give to you. You need some salt, you need, even if you run out of rice to eat, he will not vent you anything you need, fertilizers and so on. And he didn't even give the impression that he put it down on a book or something. Mm-hmm. But then when our time came, he would go to you and say, you owe me something, I take then so much paddy from you.
Paddy?
Paddy.
Take the
right.
land?
Yeah. Then the crop.
Oh, the crop. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And usually he was also very careful not to take more than half of your crops. So he worked in his mind, you know, all the things that he advanced to you. So there he gave you credit. He was the consumption, you know, supply point to you for whatever needs you may have, mm-hmm. waiting for your crop. Mm-hmm. When the crop arrived, he would come there and collect it. So he provide you with transport too, you know, and we bring the crop to the mill, and they had those mills, you know, organized, mm-hmm. and the whole system went back to Chinatown in Saigon, and I found out there were seven channels like that. They siphoned down all the needs for the farmers, and they brought back the paddy mill to be marketed, and they decide on the price. And that has existed for 100 years, even during the French colonial period. So I tried to demonstrate that it was, you know, a multi-purpose consumption production co-op, mm-hmm. because everybody participated, which provided credit, you know, means of production, you know, and transportation, everything. Mm-hmm. And that was done by just that Chinese guy. And then I tried to impress the Saigon government that time with you. I said, in order to serve the farmers down in that village, they had about 12 services, government services, agricultural services, transport services, the farmers' bank, and so on and so forth. And each time the farmer would have to go there and fill about a dozen forms and wait about a month before, you know, they get an answer. Here, the Chinese, you know, did that instantaneously. You don't have to apply for anything. And have been doing that for centuries. You see? And you try to replace that with your government services. You see? You cannot. You have to organize the people, you know, and bring the kind of same service to them in order to make them feel that they own their land, that they have their own, you know, means of production, and that they can have the security and the stability, mm-hmm. to carry out, you know, their activities down there. So that was the kind of topic that I gave them in 1960.
How did they receive that?
Oh, well, they just listened with, and that was all. And they continue with their government services, you know, with the head of the services there, you know, high-ranking civil servant, you know, mm-hmm. big boss down there. Mm-hmm. So that was it. And so that was the challenge. That was the real challenge, that you had to go down to them and organize them in that way, you see, bring them what they needed, help them in that way, in order to fight the kind of insurgency that you had at that time, but not by a government structure.
Is this kind of what you tried to do as a minister, as when you're a minister of welfare?
Yes, very much, because then I brought in the people's organization instead of taking, you know, using the structure imposed by the Ministry of Welfare. Mm-hmm. And right away, to begin with, I organized the Foreign Welfare Association, which included about over 40, you know, the big ones, and CARE, mm-hmm. World Vision, and, you know, Caritas and all this. But that's tens of millions of dollars all the time going on. And then also from the, I got help from Westmoreland, because from the U.S. troops, they had lots of things to give. Mm-hmm. And then they provide lots of goods and all kinds of things to the needy at that time. But there was charity. But for the people, you know, in the countryside, with the failure, complete failure of the strategic hamlets and the agrovilles mm-hmm. and so on, the only way was, you know, to be able to organize or provide the organizations for them to mm-hmm. help themselves there, to organize themselves. And that wouldn't have taken much, really.
So how successful were you at replacing that Chinese grocer?
Well, they have never been able to replace it, because they keep on more and more imposing government structures down there. And the less security, the more government control they put in. You see?
Okay. I wanted to see if you could comment on the situation in Laos during this time period. President Kennedy tried to neutralize Laos to make it off limits to all foreign troops, which turned out to be...
Well, right at the beginning, you know very well that Ho Chi Minh had the whole concept and vision of Indochina in his fight. Mm-hmm. First, he would claim for the liberation of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, but then he also prepared everything necessary to also impose a communist rule on the whole of Indochina. Mm-hmm. And that has always been the obsession of the American, that the Vietnam conflict was also in the context of the whole of Indochina. Mm-hmm. And the main thing was Vietnam, of course, because Laos, Cambodia, continue to be, you know, relatively smaller than Vietnam, mm-hmm. almost provinces of Vietnam. So I think that again here, Ho Chi Minh was able to outwit, you know, most experts in the military and political, you know, aspects of that Vietnam conflict, and he was able to maintain Laos in such a situation which would then play a very decisive part in the Vietnam conflict.
Talk about the Ho Chi Minh Trail complex and that supply route.
Yes.
How effective was that route, in your opinion?
Oh, it was very effective. It was very hard for them to have that kind of route to bring the supplies down. And they did an unbelievable job there. That is, on bicycles and all their back, but they managed to bring down. But it has always been very clear that, I mean, they can bring down up to a certain point. And strategically, it has always been since the French period that Ho Chi Minh Trail would be, you know, very effective just for the highlands. And that was the main thing. It was not to bring down to Tay Ninh. That is down in the Cambodian border there is too far. See, so the supplies which came down to there were relatively smaller than the ones that they stacked up in the highlands. And then eventually the whole thing began in the highlands. Mm-hmm. And the North Vietnamese regular divisions were there rather than down.
Right. Do you think it's a viable strategy? A lot of Americans now, today, a lot of military personnel, American military personnel, say that if they were allowed to go in and cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail, that would have changed the outcome of the conflict. Now, so in the context of our interview and what we've been talking about with Ho Chi Minh's cunning ability to manipulate the situation, manipulate the political situation, psychological situation in the United States and on the ground and into China. Do you think that was a viable strategy? If that had been allowed, like put a division in Laos, an American division, just stop the trail, what do you think would have happened?
Well, it was a decisive element mm-hmm. in the Vietnam conflict. But it was not the only one, you see.
Right.
If they didn't have that Ho Chi Minh trail, they would have devised other ways, you see. And then you have to go after them in other ways too.
Mm-hmm.
So they used the corridor there with the Lao and the Vietnamese border. But if you block there, they would, you know, draw another line, you know, a bit further in, you know, somewhere else, and you will have to go after them again. And in the end, you saw that they had to go after those sanctuaries,
mm-hmm.
but they did not do it in a sustained way,
right.
just to disrupt. And the ability to disrupt that supply line, I mean, it's endless, you know, it's an endless job. You cannot disrupt all the time. And even McNamara thought that they can use electronics there, you know, to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
But how can you stop them, you know, electronically, or even with the B-52s?
Mm-hmm.
Because my uncle said that they were many times on that Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they had prepared themselves, they have big holes all along.
This is your uncle's from the north?
Yes, so from the north, uh-huh. you see. And then the only thing that your bombardments, because you cannot have troops all along, you know, nearly 2,000 miles
mm-hmm.
of roads up there. You may use, you know, carpet bombing, you know, on those trails.
Mm-hmm.
But carpet bombing would be effective only if they were not notified in advance. And usually they said that 15 minutes, you know, would be effective.
15.
Yeah, to neutralize your bombardments, mm-hmm. your bombing. You see, and then as soon as your B-52s took off from Thailand or from anywhere else, you know, those Soviet fishing ships out there informed them right away. Even in 5 minutes, they were able to jump into their holes, put on the concrete cover, and wait for the bombs to stop. And you can throw any amount of bomb on them, that wouldn't disrupt their trail. You cannot bomb 24 hours a day. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hopeless. It's hopeless. You neutralize that that's the supply line thing. Yeah. Then, if you go into that army, instead of cutting the arms and the legs, the supply line, why don't you shoot at the brain?
Mm-hmm. Of course, that was off limits. We couldn't shoot at the brain.
Nothing else.
Yes.
Then you are.
Yeah. Okay. Well, speaking of bombing. One of the theories that Americans have, looking back at the war and during the war, was that bombing would change the minds of the North Vietnamese leadership to negotiate an end to the conflict sooner. That strategic bombing would change the face of the war.
I don't know, maybe in the Western way of thinking, on the American,
mm-hmm.
you know, state of mind, but in the Vietnamese, I think that very few people would say that that could, you know, deter them from anything. I mean, you can burn them to the Stone Age, and they would be still there at the Stone Age. You see, that's all. That wouldn't affect them at all.
Right.
You know? And so that's what happened. They went back to the Stone Age, and they're still there. See? So there you are.
Is it the matter?
That didn't change anything.
What you said earlier, they would wait from the Stone Age. They
yeah,
keep waiting
I said,
and waiting.
You know, just sit them out. You know, it's like the bombing. And then what you can hope, and at the most that you could hope, and Kissinger came to that conclusion, that is, with the bombing, you may achieve some kind of a stalemate.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, a waiting period for them again.
Mm-hmm.
And those people can wait any time mm-hmm. you want. You see, they can wait.
And you said earlier, a stalemate means that the North wins.
You're sure. You see, in that kind of a conflict. If you cannot, you know, stop your insurgency, then you lose.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the police trying to catch a crazy guy, you see. If you haven't caught him, you lose.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
okay.
The guy doesn't lose anything.
Well, the 1972 Christmas bombing, that's always been looked at as changing the negotiations in Paris. Well, what's your impression of that?
It didn't change anything at all, because all the basic issues were still there. They changed a few words here and there. Mm-hmm. That is to say, on the part of Hanoi, they tried to accommodate Nixon and Kissinger, you know, in order to get what they have. Basic issues, they still got the basic issues. That is to say, the presence of the North Vietnamese troops, a kind of a coalition government in South Vietnam. That's it.
Did the
end of the American intervention.
Right, that was their goal, to get the Americans out.
Yeah.
And so the changes that were made after that bombing, if that, do you think that if that let the Americans think that that bombing had been really the decisive factor in changing the negotiations to get the Americans out faster?
That is, that would be very simplistic. But it's easy for the people to accept.
But that's what
a
lot of
scholars say. The guy who fought you know, for 30 years, you bomb him in 10 days, and then, you know, in a couple of weeks he would accept your terms. I mean, that is very hard to swallow.
Well, that's what a lot of Americans argue
that.
Okay, they say, well, you know, if only we had bombed throughout the war like we did December 1972, we would have won the conflict.
Oh, sure. And then again, you see, victory would be in inverted commas. What would you mean by that?
Right.
You see, the guy would sit you out again. You know, if he can't do it right now, he would wait for another 10 years or 100 years to do it. You know, those guys were determined to get, you know, what they had in mind.
So even if Hanoi is leveled and there's nothing left, they still sit out, still wait you out.
Unless you say, I come in, you know, like, you know, Saddam Hussein, you know, you're an even guy, I have to eliminate you. And so then you come in there, and then you have a big sweep, and you change everything.
So that, in your opinion, you think that was the only way the Americans could have really
won
the war?
The only two ways. Either you, you know, come in and wipe them out, or you just accept them. That's all. But instead of, you know, playing half measures in the middle, then you play into their hands.
Mm-hmm. And then again, if the Americans say, okay, we'll invade North Vietnam with a ground force and with strategic bombing, then you worry about the Soviet and Chinese response.
Oh, sure.
So, yeah, it's a conundrum that the United States was in.
That was, you know, those what I call the strategic elements, which were very political, you know, when you start the whole conflict, you see.
Right.
And in the Second World War, you didn't have that problem, you know. The better equipment you had, you win, you know, like the First World War. The more men you had, you win, you see. Mm-hmm. But then, Vietnam was probably the very first time in human history that you had the combination, you know, of so many elements. World convention warfare, guerrilla, and political, and all kinds of things, and then the nuclear umbrella, and the international situation at that time. You know, you must give credit to Ho Chi Minh. He played very well the cards. Mm-hmm. Very well the cards.
Mm-hmm. He died in 1969. What effect did that have on the war, in your opinion?
Well, in the last years of his life, he was no longer much of an influence, you know, because the younger ones were able to take over from him, but he was still the symbol, and it didn't make much difference at the Paris talks when he died, although one of our one of the members of our delegation, Mrs. Vui, who had her cousin Kambu Kim, just the head of the NLF delegation, sitting across the table. They were first cousins, you know. And my cousin too, I was a spokesman of the NLF, was sitting across the table for years with me there. And Mrs. Vui then put on a white tunic in mourning of Ho Chi Minh. And she was a member of Saigon delegation. And that, you know, upset lots of people in Saigon. That showed, you know, that not only that he was a communist, but the man was also able, you know,
a hero.
pass on to the Vietnamese in general that he was trying to do something good for the country and the people too. Maybe he fooled them, but he was able to pass that message. So,
was there any memorial service in Paris for?
Oh, on the communist side, yes. But is even still right now, you see, the very strong anti-communist elements and people still right now, they are ferociously against Ho Chi Minh. Mm-hmm. And he was committed to his objectives. He did not hesitate to use whatever means necessary to get his goals. And he was prepared to put, you know, unbelievable sacrifices on the Vietnamese people to reach his goal. So, I don't know. History will decide whether he had the right to do it or not.
Have you ever been to Hanoi to view his body?
Oh, no, I was in Hanoi, but never went to, didn't go to the mausoleum.